Welcome to This Is Not About Your Body, where we talk about all the real shit that body image issues are actually about, because they're never just about the way you look. I'm your host, Jesse Nealand, and today I have with me Dr. Asher Larmy, who uses he, him pronouns and is a transgender non-binary doctor and fat liberationist who is campaigning for an end to medical weight stigma. I actually had Asher on season 2, I think episode 18. The episode was called Doctors Aren't Great. So if you want to, you know, swing back and check that out, there's lots of really awesome insights in that one. But I wanted to have him back on here today to kind of go a little bit deeper into weight stigma in the medical space, or through the lens of a doctor, because it's fascinating and horrifying. And welcome, Asher.
Thank you. I feel like I've gone on, I've moved on from doctors aren't great to doctors really suck. Like,
I think that was our working title as we were originally recording.
That seems very calm for me.
Yeah. I think after the fact, I was like, all right, well, I do want people to listen, so let me not push them away with just the title. Okay, so tell our listeners just a little bit about you, the work you do, and what you've kind of been focused on lately.
So I started out as a nurse when I was 18 years old. I went to medical school, graduated in 2003. I've been a general practitioner since 2009, which I always thought, like, Americans didn't even know what a general practitioner is, but I actually think you do. I think it depends on where you live as to whether or not you have one. But yeah, a lot of people do. So I kind of see everything from birth to death and everything in between. And in the UK, where healthcare is free at the point of contact, it's very unlikely that you get to, being the operative word, see a specialist of any kind, like a gynecologist or an orthopedist or a cardiologist, like an endocrinologist. You're not going to see one unless there's something desperately wrong with you. And British people will tell you, it's getting worse and worse. And this is all to do with politics and the economy and all the stuff. But I see a lot of stuff. And so I took, I guess more recently, since I think series 2, I haven't been working for the last 2 years as a doctor because, and I've come out about this now, I've kind of come clean about it. 2 years ago, a quite vile transphobic complaint was lodged against me because of my social media work. Nothing to do, it wasn't a patient, it was someone who did not know me, I never had contact with, but filed a complaint against me about my social media content. Was accused of being racist towards white people and making offensive comments about cisgender people. I don't think they were offensive. I mean, these people clearly were offended, they were not offensive. It's two very different things. So there's been a massive, like, long-standing, like, it's been over 2 years. And during those 2 years, I haven't been able to work. Nobody wants to hire someone who's being under investigation for, you know, a potentially very serious thing. So I haven't been able to work as a doctor, and that's probably a good thing. I think the universe knew what it was doing, what she was doing, I should say. She knows best. The universe knew what she was doing and has led me down this path of kind of like, could I be this person who's, you know, advocates against weight stigma, is trying to fight against weight stigma? Could I do this as a career? Like, can I turn this into something that just, like, becomes my life's work? And I decided I can and I will. And so probably the last year or so, I've been devoting myself to being, quote unquote, fat doctor, a name I came up with years ago, but I still love, actually. I'm still enjoying it.
I like it too.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would definitely say that I've gotten some, after we did our original podcast episode, I got some comments, or I don't remember how it kind of went down, but basically you are famous / maybe a little infamous on the internet in some ways. And so some people would be like, wait a second, isn't the fat doctor, like, kind of problematic? And I was like, maybe tell me what you heard. I don't know. Right. And I do feel like it does seem like people take issue with a lot of what you say. And I love it. I mean, I understand, you know, I think there's a certain tone policing thing happening that's like, could you be a little bit nicer about how mad you are about weight stigma? Would be super, super lovely for us to not have our feelings hurt
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
I understand it, but like, I just, yeah, everything I see, I'm like, this is so nuanced. It is like just liberatory in all of the ways. And yeah, I'm thrilled to have you back.
Thank you. I think, I've learned over the last few years to, give people the benefit of the doubt and also to respect people and allow them to self-select whether they're selecting into what I have to say or opting out of it. I have no
Sure.
issues with people turning around saying, I'm not interested in what you have to say. I don't want to
Yeah.
listen to you. I don't want to hear you. Like, sure, I'm not trying to force my opinions on anyone. I'm not trying to change the way we do things. I'm trying to say, here's another option
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it's better. But also at the same time saying, hey, like when the GMC, the General Medical Council, who hold my license to practice and have accused me of being offensive. And actually what's really interesting is the two tweets that they said were offensive, I don't think were offensive at all. I was like, I think I'm pretty sure I, as a trans person, have the right to say that I am fearful of cisgender people, which is what I express. Like, I'm pretty
Oh,
sure I'm
I
allowed to
see.
say that. I didn't say anything bad about cis people. I just said, it's very
Right.
hard for me to trust you. It is. If you've got a problem with that, then that's a you problem, not a me problem. But like I said, I think sure, sometimes I am very direct. Sometimes my brand of, the way I am, the authentic version of me is not everyone's cup of tea. So if you don't like me, just ignore me. And if you do like me, then come hang out with me. And I think over time, I've noticed that people are beginning to kind of either like opt in or opt out. And I like that.
Interesting. Do you know what though? That just makes me think of one of the very first anti-racism books that I ever bought. Unfortunately, I can't even remember the author's name now, but it was highly recommended in the spaces that I was like seeing stuff, and I was like, okay, I'm finally gonna do this. I'm gonna dive in and learn some shit. And I was so turned off by the tone. I was like, she's so angry at me specifically, it felt like, that I couldn't make it through the book. I think I unfollowed her. And then years later, when I picked the book back up, I was like, oh, this is actually all makes perfect sense. Because at that point, I had had enough of those insights and connections to understand why even it didn't land day one. So I feel like there's also that like, if people aren't ready for you in the journey, that's that they're not ready. And sometimes it
Yeah.
takes really polite
Sure.
liberation work on step one.
I love that, as I'm getting to know this community that we're all invested in the same thing, right? We all want people to stop discriminating against people based on their size, body size. I think we can all agree on that. And we all have different ways of going around about it. I do not believe one way is better than the other. I actually think that on the other end, when people in the community are like, you're not being firm enough, you need to be more firm. Because believe it or not, sometimes I'm accused of being too polite, which I find hilarious.
Of
But
course. I mean, people on
yeah,
both sides, right? They're gonna be
right.
like,
But
come my way.
what I love is that everybody, like, sometimes it's gonna take a thin person spreading this
Yeah.
message first for people to opt in, and that's cool. I'm all right with that.
Absolutely. 100%.
They'll come to me when they're ready. And before then they have all the benefits of all the other amazing people out there, many of whom I've gotten to know and am following and really love the stuff that they're doing. So yeah, I'm not everybody's cup of tea. Do you know what Marmite is? You won't know what that is.
Marmite, isn't that the
Yeah.
Australian salty thing?
Right. So you know something about it. So okay, they
Put
have
on toast, I think.
Vegemites.
Oh,
They have
wrong one.
Vegemite.
Okay.
Not confused. They have Vegemite. We have Marmite. We'll argue till the cows come home about whose is better. But it is a yeast extract. It's the color of, it's not quite black, but it's almost black. It's an inky color. It's very, very salty. And you put it on, usually on toast with butter and then this kind of a small amount of stuff. Now, the like advertising campaign for years in the UK was Marmite, you either love it or you hate it. And so there's an entire generation of us that have grown up that in the UK will just say, oh, I'm like Marmite. You either love me or you hate me. And I think that doesn't translate, unfortunately, across the world, which is a shame.
I don't know that we have anything that known. I mean, we have plenty of divisive items, but okay. So I wanted to ask you, a lot of what you've been posting lately is like this completely straightforward idea that if we had a safe and sustainable way to get someone to lose weight, then it wouldn't be so crazy for doctors to recommend it, right? Like, even though there's a lot of issues sprinkled throughout that entire sentence that I just said, one of the main things that I hear you talking about is, like, we don't have that. Therefore, what the F are doctors doing by recommending it? So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that.
Well, to me, there are four things. The first is that it's unsustainable. There isn't an effective way to lose weight in the long term. I mean, we have been studying this now for over 100 years.
Yeah.
And just because there isn't evidence for something doesn't mean it doesn't work, right? Like, there are plenty of things that I will say, look, there's no evidence for this, but you can try it. But when people have spent thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe millions over the years to try and prove that something is possible, and every single time they fail, it's got to make you wonder whether maybe it's time to give up now, right?
Yeah.
We've tried, we've failed. We tried again, we failed. We tried different things, we failed. There is literally no study out there that shows that weight loss is sustainable. It's almost always possible in the first year. There will be groups of people that will struggle to lose weight. So, for example, if you have insulin resistance, if you have lipedema, if you have certain medical conditions that will make it harder for you to lose weight, you can probably still lose weight. You just have to resort to much more drastic measures. But by and large, the vast majority of the population can lose weight in the first year, some very easily. Almost nobody can sustain it. And I don't want to put a number on it because it differs between different studies. And, you know, we don't have an accurate number, but it's almost certainly unsustainable for the vast majority of people. And if you don't believe me, ask yourself, when was the last time you managed to lose weight and keep it off for long periods of time with a caveat and have not developed an eating disorder at that time? Because, of course, if you are have an eating disorder, then that kind of changes things.
Yeah.
So I guess we go so far as to say there is no healthy way to sustain weight loss. But that's just part one. Because even if you're like, well, okay, but even if it's a couple of percent of the population, there's still some hope. Yeah, but even if you can lose weight, what's it going to do for you? From a health point of view now, I'm coming at you from a medical point of view. Nothing. We looked at diabetics. Is it going to improve their outcomes? Nope. Did a whole study, 10 years we studied them, quit after 10 years because we realized, nope, it's having absolutely no impact whatsoever. We did the same for pre-diabetics. If we get them to lose weight, is it going to stop them from becoming diabetic? 10 years, 20 years down the line? Nope, apparently not. We did one for, we've done a big one on osteoarthritis of the knee. Post knee replacement surgery, did weight loss prior to surgery improve the outcomes 1 year and 7 years post-surgery? Nope, didn't. We keep doing these studies over and over again, thinking, definitely, weight loss is going to make a difference. Going on a diet is going to make a difference. It never does. So it's ineffective. So it's unsustainable. It's ineffective. Oh, and by the way, did I mention it's really dangerous? We don't talk about that enough.
Yeah.
Physical consequences, the hormonal imbalances. There are so many hormones in your brains that are impacted by starving yourself. The short-term impact on your mood and your ability to concentrate. You know, if you cut down carbs, you are less able to perform certain tasks, especially when it comes to memory. That's a study out there that shows that, right? Sure. So then you've got the more
also, I feel like that's so intuitive. Like, I feel like people know that on some level.
You think they did. And I think we probably do know that on some level, but we ignore it.
Yeah.
So what? So you haven't got as good a memory. What's the big deal? Right. it's worth it to get thin.
Right.
But then you've got your long-term complications. You've got your eating disorders. You've got your, you know, you've got your weight cycling, and there isn't enough evidence, but the emerging evidence is showing just how dangerous this actually is. The impact this is having on your insulin pathways and your cholesterol pathways, it's having on your adrenal glands and your stress and your cortisol levels and all sorts. There are untold consequences and well-known consequences of going on a diet. So now we have unsustainable, we have pretty ineffective, and we have harmful. And then finally, and I hate to say it, but it's completely unfair. It's completely unfair because only fat people are told to go on a diet, by and large. Unfortunately, now I'm hearing that even thin people are being told to go on a diet. But for the most part in health, it's only one group of the population. If this works, then it should work for everybody. But they're punishing fat people because they believe that fat people somehow are a burden to society, wherever we convinced ourselves that fat people must be made thin. So yeah. going on a diet or taking a Ozempic or having bariatric surgery is necessary, but it's very unfair because it's discriminating against a certain group of population.
Yeah.
We have no control. I know they think we do, but we don't. We can't control our weight. We can't shrink ourselves. We are literally unshrinkable. I don't understand how we can justify it. I no longer understand how we can justify prescribing intentional weight loss to anyone.
Yeah. So to clarify, we do have control over our choices, maybe actually less than we think. So I'm gonna put a little pin in that. But like, people, I think, they often hear we don't have control over our weight, and they think you're saying we have no control over what we eat or how we move or the choices we make, right? I don't think that's necessarily a conscious logic leap, but it is where people go to because we have learned that those are the same thing, that what you eat and how much you weigh are the same thing, basically.
Yeah.
So just to be super clear.
Yeah.
You do, for the most part, have control over what you do. It is these outcomes that we do not have control over. And that is to say that, like, if you happened to have gained weight because of behavioral things that are within your control, which some people do, and then you change those behavioral things, you may lose weight and it may be sustainable. But the idea that weight is caused by behavioral things is completely not the case for most people. Does that track?
Yeah. So we did a study not that long ago. It was published a few months ago now. I can't remember if it was, I think it was beginning of 24, so it would have been like a couple of months ago. It's a really fascinating study where they looked at the UK Biobank, which is perhaps one of the biggest data sort of databases that we have access to now. It looks at, I can't remember, I'm thinking it's 100,000 people, possibly it's 200,000 people. It's a massive amount of people. We've got data from 2001 until now. So it was an American study, but it looked at the UK Biobank. And they were specifically targeted at studying fat people. So they only looked at fat people. And they were trying to understand sort of what they were looking at social isolation, actually. That's what they were particularly interested in, social isolation and how that impacted, quote unquote, obesity.
Interesting.
But in order to do the study, they had to compare it with lots of other markers, right? Because you had to adjust for all these other markers that could potentially impact it as well. And so one of the byproducts of this study, whilst it wasn't actually the whole point of the study, one of the beautiful byproducts of this study is it looked at, and I've done a blog post about this if you want to see the pictures, it looked at what was most impactful. So they looked at, for example, cardiovascular disease, and they were like, looked at what was most impactful. And they listed, I think, was out of 20, all the things in order of what was most impactful. So with cardiovascular disease, it was the obvious ones to start with. One of the biggest risk factors is having diabetes. We knew this. Another big fat risk factor, having high blood pressure. We knew this. The biggest risk factor, by far, smoking. We knew this. This is not news to any of us. But here's where it gets interesting. You have you've got social isolation really high up. I believe it was fourth. You have social deprivation really high up. And then you keep going down, you have things like eating disorders, various other things. And then I believe in some of them, now I'm not going to be able to remember the numbers exactly, but diet and exercise are very low down on the list. So we believe that when we think fat, I hear you, most of us think we are fat because we are eating too much and we're not exercising enough.
Right.
But actually, that's probably not true. In fact, diet and exercise, they play a role, but a very small role compared to things like social deprivation, social isolation, and various other things. And we've known this. We know that genetics controls about 80% of our weight, 70 to 80%. We know that social deprivation has an impact. And as an analogy, let's just take a job interview, right? I want you to imagine a job interview, you've got two candidates. And they're both going in, they're both doing all the right things at the job interview. Chances are one particular candidate is going to be more successful than the other. And that very much depends on where they went to school, you know, where they went to college, what they look like, whether they're going to fit in, et cetera, et cetera. The other person could be working just as hard, even harder, but still not get the job.
Right.
And it's the same with weight. Like there are some people who will, you know, just say, hey, I'm giving up beer. And their weight drops massively.
Right.
And they've just made a conscious choice to give up beer. And that's it. Boom. Weight drops massively. You could argue that they were heavy because they were drinking beer, but it doesn't matter. The whole point is that's what happened. You got somebody who's like, I'm going to cut out beer, and it does nothing to their waistline or to the number on the scales. They're still doing the same thing. It's just two very different responses. And that's because our body is complicated, and it's because we're all different. We're, you know, no two of us are the same. And so, yeah, I mean, when we talk about choices versus weight, I agree with you. We can all make the same choices and have very different outcomes. And that comes with gaining weight and losing weight. So we do have, and you're right, it's complicated. How much control do we have over what we eat? We do, but also we don't. You know, when we start talking about food deserts, and we start talking about, your geography and your culture and all sorts of other things, and eating the sort. I mean, God, you could get the moment you start pulling at that thread. Whoops.
Absolutely.
But I agree with you. You and I could sit down and say, all right, we're both going to do exactly the same thing. We're going to cut out this from our diet. We're going to do this much exercise, the same exercise, and we will have a completely different reaction. And that's life.
Do you know, I think the job hunting analogy is a really interesting one, because we definitely acknowledge in most other areas the fact that you probably should. Most people are going to recommend working hard inside your field, you know, working hard at school, whatever it is. It's sort of like maximizing your opportunities given what you got. And they will also understand that that does not guarantee you a specific job or outcome or income or whatever. We get that. But the exact same thing is here. And we don't get that.
Right.
Like, it is still assumed, the assumptions inside of weight stigma are still that if you're fat, you are doing unhealthy behaviors. And if you would just change those unhealthy behaviors, you would suddenly be fixed and cured and magically thin. And it doesn't make sense when we look at literally every other area of life and go, well, we can control the input, but not the output.
Right. And if you take that job analogy just that little bit further, what you have to understand, and I guess this kind of is true anyway, is that the person who is trying their best but doesn't get the job for whatever reason, what's more important is they're getting punished for that. When you're fat, you're getting punished for being fat. So it's not that you have different outcomes. It goes beyond that. Yeah. Same with a job. If you're not able to gain employment, you're punished. You have less money. You have less everything. It's the same with being fat. You are literally punished. And that's when it comes to accessing healthcare, but it's also employment, and it's also access to a variety of areas of society, travel, clothing, and also mental and emotional well-being, spiritual well-being. All these things are impacted by the fact that you're essentially punished. So even though you try, and you do try hard, the assumption that I sit on my butt all day and eat lots of quote unquote processed food, you know, first of all, if I did that, it's none of your damn business. I can do 100%. Whatever I want. But the assumption that that's automatically, you assume that's what I do, is wrong. Yeah. And then you punish me for it. And that's worse.
So that reminds me, one of your posts recently was like, I don't remember how you put it. Basically, guess what? People who exercise are not morally superior to people who don't.
Right.
Hot take, because that's one of those like sacred cows in our culture, that there is just, even people who are working really hard to like dismantle this stuff will often end up saying things like, well, as long as you're healthy, as long as you're working out, as long as whatever it is, then it's okay to be fat. So that we've got this qualifier on it through this like really bizarre moral lens. And I love that you just call it out, like, actually, no.
And you know, when you have existed on the peripheries of society, which I think I have for quite a long time, fat, but also queer, and also more recently out as trans and Jewish. And like, I never really fit in for lots of reasons. And when you're on the outskirts and when you're on the periphery, you meet a whole bunch of other people who also don't fit in. And what you realize is that these things that we as a society hold sacred are actually massively exclusionary. So we'll take exercise. Yeah, sure. If you're able-bodied and you can, like, that's nice. Yeah. Take health. I mean, some people aren't healthy. They're born with illnesses. are we, you know, and this, so when someone says, as long as you're healthy, well, dude, what happens to all the people that aren't healthy? Yeah. What about them? It's, and we don't realize we're being exclusive. It's not our fault. There's no judgment here. I've done this most of my life, but I'm just getting more and more used to it. And I remember being queer. I remember being queer in the 90s. And I remember being told, well, as long as you don't put your lifestyle, you know, rub your lifestyle in our faces. That was what people said.
I grew up with that 100%.
Yeah. Okay, you do you, but as long as you don't put your lifestyle in my face.
And don't put it in my face.
Yeah, don't rub it in. I was always like, by what? Existing?
Quite literally.
I'm not allowed to do everything that you're allowed to do just because you don't like the look of my lifestyle. So I think I come from a place of having been told that since I was a teenager and just thinking that's not fair. And perhaps that's why I'm very blunt, because, you know, I made that comment about exercise. You're not morally superior just because you exercise, because you're not. And I've met a whole bunch of people. A lot of my clients will have chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, a lot of invisible disabilities. They will be neurodivergent. That, you know, often these things are completely ignored when people talk about health. And so they'll be like, you know, exercise is great, but you know what happens to me when I exercise? And I'm like, yeah, because I've listened, I've paid attention, I get it. You are not morally superior just because you exercise. And I've just written an email about this. There were times in my life, believe it or not, within the last decade, I was running like 3 miles every other day. I was going to several workout classes a week. You know, there were times when I spent most of my time in the gym and I thought I was amazing. I thought I was morally superior. Interspersed between times when I couldn't be bothered to get up ever and I had a very sedentary life. And now I'm just like, well, I was me the whole time, and me going to the gym felt more virtuous, felt morally superior, but was in no way morally superior. And often at times it coexisted with periods of my life when I wasn't in a great place, if I'm honest, and I was compensating by trying to control, you know, exercise. So there's no judgment. And hey, like, I've got no problems with people who exercise, you know, I think it's great. But for me, exercise or movement nowadays, I believe it should be pleasurable. I'm all about pleasure and hedonism. And if you like moving, like, sometimes I love a good stretch. It feels real good. And I love a walk with the dogs. And if you get off on running, I've got a friend who just loves a run, loves it, makes them feel so much better. Then I'm so 100% behind you. But if you're doing it for reasons other than that, then it's not a bad thing, but I would call that into question.
Totally. So coming from the fitness industry, I think there was like this really painful part of my journey as I'm like unlearning basically everything I had ever learned. Very humbling and devastating for my ego. One of them was basically realizing that I had been enjoying this super special status as morally superior because I lifted a lot and I, quote unquote, looked like I lifted a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Because I was lean, muscular, and strong. People in coffee shops thought I was morally superior. You know what I mean? Like, I did not do anything to earn it, but I certainly had been enjoying it. And I was like, uh-oh. Like, I think I have to give that up because that's not in alignment with my values anymore. Oh, God.
Yeah.
As long people love to give you that status, though.
Right.
They're like, you, a special disciplined person. I was like, I'm just doing what I wanted, but thank you, I guess. Thank you.
Right. I get that. You know, I get that a lot with being a doctor. It makes me feel super uncomfortable.
Interesting.
Like, you're a doctor. And I'm like, it's just a job. It does not make me superior in any way. But of course, I understand why people think that. And I get that that's what we've been told in society. But as I said at the beginning of this podcast, doctors suck. And that was me being polite. So I no longer take it as a compliment. But I understand that certain people are afforded certain, like you say, status. And it's hard to give up.
Yeah.
Giving up medicine, I was like, oh, people aren't going to respect me for being a doctor anymore. Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. I would say that I feel now very similarly that, like, if I were to be, I mean, I don't work out that way anymore, so it wouldn't really happen. But if I were to get like that kind of statusy compliment, I wouldn't feel like a compliment. It would feel really uncomfortable and icky.
Amazing.
So I wanted to ask, to go back, this idea that I heard you say studies did not show what about diabetes and heart disease and whatever, that losing weight didn't help. And I just, like, I marked it because I wanted to ask you to explain that again, maybe in more detail, because I know everybody learned the opposite of that.
Yeah. And to be fair, I think when I make such a bold statement, I think it's very important to clarify that. And I'm glad you gave me the opportunity. So I'll name some studies, big studies. They're not the only studies out there. These are the ones I think are most useful because I think they have the most robust evidence. So diabetes is a good one. A, I know a lot about diabetes. I used to treat a lot of diabetes. I also have type 2 diabetes. And I've also dealt with the stigma of type 2 diabetes for quite some time. The fear of it and then the actual diagnosis of it and then having to come to terms with it. So it's something I can relate to.
Yeah.
So So what I'm saying is I can talk about diabetes, but I could also talk about all sorts of other conditions as well. I'll use diabetes as an example, again, because we have a lot of robust evidence.
Yeah.
So there's three studies. There was the Diabetes Prevention Program Outcome Study, sometimes called DPPOS. What they did was, this was, I think, end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s. They took a group of people with impaired glucose tolerance, which you would probably know as pre-diabetes. Same thing. And so they'd all been diagnosed with pre-diabetes, and then they followed them for 3 years initially, and they were separated into three groups. One did nothing, control group. One took metformin, and one went on a diet, you know, and lost, I think, 7% of their body weight. So they followed them up from 3 years initially, and then almost all of them, at least 80% of them, joined the outcome study and have been followed up ever since. Now it's almost 20 years, or possibly even longer than 20 years. So we have a lot of evidence. And what's fascinating about this study is, first of all, 40%, now 20 years later, 40% of people still haven't developed diabetes. So there's 40% of people who tested positive for pre-diabetes end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, still haven't developed diabetes, which a lot of people are like, really?
Yeah.
But what we looked at with those groups, and initially the initial findings was the weight loss group and the metformin group were less likely to develop diabetes than the control group. But that was only 3 years worth of data, and 3 years worth of data isn't great. But if you look at the 10-year data, the 15-year data, now the 20-year data, what we found was there's no difference between the group. Actually, the weight loss group, when you're looking at number percentage of people that convert per year, the weight loss group is actually slightly higher than the control group. You believe that? So people who went on a diet actually ended up having a slight, but it's not numbers that are worth talking about. So that is a really good study at showing, actually, even if you have pre-diabetes, losing weight isn't going to make much of an impact.
Yeah.
But even more importantly, they now looked at the data. Okay, it's been 20 years. How has that impacted people when it comes to having a heart attack or a stroke or cancer or any of these things that are linked to pre-diabetes and diabetes, that we the actual, what I like to call health outcomes?
Yeah.
Again, no difference. Absolutely no difference whatsoever. So that was DPPOS. Sorry, I have to go have a glass of water.
So...
You don't like it, do you?
No, I love it. I love it. I'm like trying to think, okay, so what are people going to be asking themselves in this moment as they're hearing this? And my thought is like, just brain melting, or that you're lying. Like, I don't think people can process it because it's so opposite to everything that people learn in fitness, diet, wellness culture.
Sure. But I mean, the DPPOS is a huge study, and there are lots of papers that have been written about it. I mean, you can, I actually wrote a book about navigating insulin resistance. It's not me trying to plug it. You can buy it off my website. But if you want the actual links to the study, they're all there. I've listed, I looked at, so the 3 year study, I looked at the 10 year, the 15 year data, the year data, and the two 20 year data studies. And all of them say the same thing. As I said, the first 3 years, it looks more promising. But I always prefer to look at long-term data, because long-term data gives us a much more accurate picture.
Yeah.
What happens in 3 years can be impacted by all sorts of factors, but 10 years is sturdy data. And this was again, we're talking thousands of people, I think. Well, definitely hundreds, a huge number. So that was DPOS. I remember I said there's three studies. The second was Look Ahead. Look Ahead was a study where they, I can't remember all the things they had to do, but basically it was a group, two groups, who were diabetic now, not pre-diabetic, type 2 diabetes. And half of them, basically, it was a randomized controlled trial. You either went into the control group or you went into the kind of intensive lifestyle intervention group. And they believed that if you were a diabetic who lost weight and exercised and did all the things that your diabetic doctors will tell you to do, that there'd be better health outcomes, fewer heart attacks, fewer cancers, fewer strokes, fewer deaths. That's what they believed. That was what they were aiming to prove. So they waited for 10 years. And at the 10-year mark, they stopped the study. And they stopped the study because there was no difference. The control group and the weight loss group.
Right, right.
No difference. So they said, well, we can't keep doing this. We can't afford to keep doing this.
Oh, my God.
They stopped. So again, you probably would have found after a year that the weight loss group, their A1C would have come down, and maybe they came off their medications and maybe their blood pressure improved. Sure, right. In the first year, you're going to find lots of amazing things. But over 10 years, there was no difference. So here's me, diabetic, diagnosed a year ago. First thing I'm told, exercise, lose weight, exercise, lose weight, exercise, lose weight. Why? Because it will improve your outcomes. Are you sure? Because there's evidence that proves otherwise. I mean, there's no question about this evidence. And then lastly, we have the direct study. Now, the sneakily, the evidence for the direct study only came out last year, and they haven't published any decent papers about it. And I know why. It's obvious. They took 300 people. This was in the UK, actually in Scotland, which is where I live. So very offensive to me. They took 300 people who were diabetic, and then they put them on a very low calorie diet. The 800 calorie meal supplement drinks that you probably heard of. For 2 months or 3 months, I can't remember. And then they followed them up. And what they found in the first year, 50% in remission. It was a miracle. But I wasn't surprised. Second year, it had dropped. Wasn't surprised about that. By the fifth year, what they found was less than 3% had managed to stay in remission. Most people had stopped being in remission. And they didn't publish any data about what happened to the people who did the very low calorie diet, didn't go stay in remission. We don't know what happened to them. Who knows if they ended up with worse outcomes? We've not got the data.
Right.
But again, I went in, saw my diabetic nurse, was told, oh, if your new diagnosis, if you go on a very low calorie diet, you will put your diabetes into remission. And I was like, cool, prove it. Oh, we've got the direct study. I was like, no, you don't. I actually read that. You don't have the evidence to back this statement up. And so
it's
people-
It's such odd, fantastical thinking to be like, well, because it works for a little bit, it's probably just a matter of willpower to make it work forever. We have no proof that that's true, but we really feel like it should be. So go ahead and do that.
Exactly.
It's such a fantasy.
Just keep trying, and one of you will get it one day. It's people always ask me, but how can this be possible? I'll put the evidence in front of their faces and be like, here is the study. Sometimes I show the graph. Reagan Chastain says this a lot as well. When we talk, we moan about the fact that sometimes we'll be talking to people and just, look, here, see, graph. People can't accept it because it goes against everything we thought about. But what I like to remind people is the reason you believe that weight loss is a cure for any health disease is because the weight loss industry has invested billions over the last few decades to make you think that way. They have infected every area of society. So no one is willing to believe the science, the data. Yeah. They just can't get over it. So they hear it and then they're just like, well, Ash is cherry picking the data. I'm like, find me a better study than Look Ahead. I mean, it was a groundbreaking study, but I must be wrong.
And it would be bad enough if this was just like, articles in magazines and news sources, but these are, for the most part, everybody's doctor is telling them, oh, be careful not to gain weight, or please lose weight because you're going to get diabetes. And if you do have diabetes now, the end goal is always weight loss. And it's absolutely so interconnected with the medical system, particularly around diabetes. I would say in the US, maybe more than any of the others. I mean, I know there's a lot of crossover with a lot of different outcomes, but diabetes is very much like the American connection with obesity and diabetes. It's like the Venn diagram is a perfect circle.
It is. And you know why? Because the American Diabetes Platinum sponsor has been Novo Nordisk for, I don't know, for over a decade. Novo Nordisk is spending $500,000, half a million a year on the American Diabetes Association. Do not think for one second that the American Diabetes Association is a charity. It is a corporate mouthpiece for weight loss manufacturers like Novo Nordisk.
Go back, because I don't know what Norvo, I don't know what you're saying. Norvo,
oh, you don't know
Nordisk?
Who Novo Nordisk are?
No.
You haven't heard me ranting and raving enough. Jesse,
okay.
You need to,
or maybe I just, I'm used to reading it in words and I haven't heard it out loud.
Or maybe you just like need to totally rein me in right now because I may accidentally spew out a lot of stuff. But
no, just give me the context.
They make Ozempic.
Oh, so the, you're saying that the company, a weight loss company basically is in charge of the American Diabetes Association, you're saying? Oh. Yeah.
No, I mean, don't
of
laugh.
Of course it is.
Yes, yes,
no,
they are.
I got you.
The platinum sponsors are Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly, the makers of Ozempic, Wegovy, Saxenda, and Mounjaro. And they have been for over a decade.
Awesome. And I want you
to know that your CDC takes all the direction. The CDC takes direction from the ADA. And when the CDC is called into question, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Because the ADA said we should, and we trust them because they are the experts in this condition. Go look it up. And there's a fantastic...
I'm not surprised, but I don't... Yeah, I did not know that. That is upsetting and also, like, makes perfect sense.
There's an article in Science. It's a Science... They might make that up. Can't remember what journal it is. And maybe I'll send it to you and you can link it to the show notes.
Sounds good, yeah.
I'd love for everybody to have a read of this because it's a you know, magazine article. It's not a journal. Like anyone can read it. And it describes the PR stunt that is pre-diabetes and how why it's different in America than it is anywhere else in the world. So when you were saying, oh, I think it's really bad here, you have it worse than anyone else because of the ADA and the CDC.
Understood.
And if you just, people would just read this article, they'd be like, oh, that explains so much.
Okay, I love it. Please do, and I'll link to it. Also, it just occurred to me in real time here that even the term pre-diabetes is like, we don't have pre-depression, you know, we don't have like pre-divorce, I don't know, like there's nothing else, pre-migraines, we don't have pre-anything. It's an interesting way of looking at stuff.
You kind of have pre-cancer.
True. Yeah, precancerous cells.
Precancerous cells. But let me tell you something about precancerous cells. So one of the first places we ever found precancerous cells were in the cervix. So we do pap smears now, right?
Yeah.
What the great thing about precancerous cells is we know that if we find them and we get rid of them, we will prevent cancer. Isn't that amazing? So if you have your pap smear and we find abnormalities in your pap smear, you will have biopsy and then you'll have treatment. And then you will have follow-up, and then you won't get cervical cancer. Nowadays, we can prevent cervical cancer, which is even better news. But before, what we were doing is we were looking for the precancerous cells. We were getting rid of them. The thing about pre-diabetes and why it's not the same as pre-cancer is because when we identify it, it does not mean you're going to develop diabetes. So it means that there is a, I think it's under 5% chance that over the next 10 years, you're going to develop diabetes. It's a very small chance. And so a lot of international experts have rejected the term. You'll notice the WHO doesn't use it. And you'll notice that many other experts don't use the term because they believe it's misleading. We also know that there is nothing you can do to prevent pre-diabetes from turning into diabetes. Remember I told you there was a study, BPPOS?
Right.
So it's not like a smear.
So... A pap smear,
yeah, like a pap or mammograms to look at breast tissue to see if you can pick up early cancer or prostate screening or bladder cancer screening or any kind of cancer screening. The whole point is if we pick something up early and we do something about it, we prevent something from happening.
Right.
This does not happen with pre-diabetes. So that's why. But what's really sad is since the literally invention, because it was really genuinely an invented condition, One doctor who, by the way, if you read this article, massively regrets what he's done. And the guy who developed the term pre-diabetes now says, if you find it, do nothing. Check it again in 3 years' time. That's what he says. He's on record saying that. But anyway, the sad thing about it is that since this term developed, our countries, especially your country, has been spending millions, billions of public funding on quote unquote preventing diabetes. Who benefits from that? The weight loss industry. But who suffers? Cancer patients, because they took the money from cancer prevention and put it into pre-diabetes. Wow. So this pre-cancer that we know actually it works, it took the money from that and stuck it into something that does nothing for the benefit of drug companies like Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly and Weight Watchers and everyone else that benefits from weight loss. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it.
It makes so much sense. I mean, the idea that there's not like a pre-diabetic cell, like, right? I mean, it is, it's just this vague collection of statistics or whatever they're looking at to diagnose it. It makes so much sense. It also makes me want to start calling everything like pre whatever, you know, like children are just pre-adults. Like that's, I just feel like it's a lens. You can look at the world that way.
I think we can have fun with this. I think you and I should be on each other's social media from now onwards, kind of like bringing this up on a regular
basis. As a pre-elderly person, I feel very confidently saying this. You're not going to stop it. It's going to be that way no matter what. So something that I see you talk about that I think is really important, especially for anybody who has diabetes, who is afraid of diabetes, who is deeply invested in trying to avoid diabetes. This is such a thing. I hear you talk about, as someone who has it and knows all this background, that you are not going to go the direction of what the doctors are prescribing for you. But you still have to live inside of a system that's going to constantly give you misinformation, who is going to discriminate and, you know, marginalize you based on these factors. And it kind of fucks with your eating, right? Like I saw you write that thing that was like, listen, there's a lot to balance here because there are some factual outcomes about what you eat and how that manages blood sugar. There are also like the need to not be restrictive in dieting and stressed. And like, it just, it's very messy, right? So I would love to hear you talk a little bit about that experience.
Well, the first thing that I don't do, because I, again, have read the evidence, is I don't measure my blood sugar ever.
Love it.
I'm a type 2 diabetic, and I know that the only reason that you need to measure your blood sugar is if there is a risk of your blood pressure of sugar going very low, if you're type 2. Because even if our blood sugar gets really, really high, nothing bad will happen to us. Not really. I mean, we'll notice it. We'll feel ill.
Yeah, you'll feel shitty. Yeah.
But we won't end up in hospital. Now, if you're a type 1, that's completely different. You can go into a ketoacidotic coma and it can be very serious. So this does not apply for type 1s. This is type 2s. The only time we need to know about our blood sugar is if it's going too low. So there are certain medications that can make you hypo. So glycoside is one of the common ones. So if you're on glycoside, you must measure your blood sugar. And if you're on insulin, for sure, because that can make you hypo, you must measure your blood sugar. But other than that, there's no need. And even if you are measuring your blood sugar, you want to measure your blood sugar when you're fasted, because that's all that's important. What people are doing that I've noticed more and more and more, especially in the States, because I think that's what they're being told to do, is measure their blood sugar at random times. Completely useless, because your blood sugar will spike. Everybody's blood sugar will spike. You don't have to be diabetic to have spiking blood sugar.
Yeah.
And that's normal. So I rely on, as I should, much more long-term numbers, which is the A1C that looks at your blood pressure, blood sugar over the last 3 months, 2 to 3 months.
Yeah.
That I get done, as I should do. I'm on medications. And when my A1C is high and I think actually, you know, we agree that's a bit too high, we need to do something, I will take action. And that usually involves upping a dose or we'll take, I've now just started a new medication, which makes me super thirsty. So look, I live in the real world. I want to do what I can to reduce my risk factors as much as possible. I go in for my regular screening and I am careful enough. You know, I don't just kind of go, oh, I'm just going to wing it and hope for the best. But I don't take dietary advice. And I have a nurse that I see regularly. She knows that I don't take dietary advice. She gives it to me every time. I laugh in her face.
Oh my God.
But she's very lovely. And I laugh in her face and I'm like, don't start. And then she goes, I won't. But she just feels like she has to give it to me, even yeah. though she knows who I am. So I don't get invested. And I also, there's something I learned about when I was dieting, even when I was dieting and I was knee, like, you know, neck deep in diet culture, was that the more you weighed yourself, the worse it was. And it wasn't good to weigh yourself regularly because weight fluctuated.
Yep.
So even though that's a terrible thing that I learned in diet culture, I think it applies to blood sugar. The more you're measuring it and focusing on it, the worse it is. You need to take a step back because yeah. actually all of the data is saying, relax the reins.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
not type one. This is type two, and it's a very different condition. And stress plays a much more important role in type two.
Yeah.
Don't forget, type one, your pancreas isn't working. Type two, it's not your pancreas, it's your cells. Your pancreas, especially at the beginning, works just fine.
Yeah.
It's the cells that are malfunctioning. And stress has a huge impact on our cells. Yeah. So I'm trying
to reduce... Which, by the way, is so true of most of the things that people, like chronic pain, IBS, you know, yeah. migraines. There's so many things that essentially are not a structural problem.
Yeah.
They are stress related or influenced or whatever. And so the more you stress about your health issues, the worse your health issues are going to get. And it is a nasty cycle.
Exactly. And this is where, I mean, I'm still working on the food thing. It takes sometimes the joy out of food because you're constantly trying to, you know, I sometimes find myself like, you know, I'm trying to pair my proteins and my fats and my fibers and stuff. Like I can't just go, fuck it, I'm going to have whatever I want. Although I do sometimes, and again, this is something that we need to practice, is that by trying to be strict all the time, I'm causing myself too much stress. It's freaking me out. It's worrying me.
Yeah.
So I allow myself, for the most part, to try and find ways that I can nourish my body with things that I love. I'm not cutting out sugar or anything stupid like that, but I try and maintain a balanced diet. At the same time, if I'm really craving something sweet, you know, like unprocessed, like processed sugar, high fat content, I will eat the damn thing and I will not worry about it. And that's how I'm coping with being a relatively new onset diabetic. And I'm one of the many, many people that got diagnosed post COVID.
Yeah.
And I think I've said to a lot of people, my husband and I, no relation, I assure you, both got it at the same time. So just the stress just tipped us over the edge. We were like, uh-oh. So but thanks.
So I think that goes back to also the morality thing around like fitness. There is there's so many morality things around food as well here, but this one particular one is like never making choices that are bad for your health or make you feel bad, right? Like there's definitely an idea, you know, intuitive eating, unlearning diet culture. I think most people kind of, once they get enough information, they're on board with like going through a phase of eat whatever you want, but it's in the service of eventually eating in ways that help you thrive. But then that takes out of account the fact that sometimes, like it's that zoomed back thing. Sometimes in a healthy relationship with food, you eat the wrong thing that makes you feel kind of sick for a while. And there's literally nothing wrong with that. Assuming there's no actual consequences that do need to be watched out for, which certainly can exist. Mm. It's often the healthiest thing we can do is sometimes give ourselves a bellyache because we just ate straight sugar because that was what we were really needing to take the brakes off this like stressful relationship with food that was building.
Right. And sometimes we are eating to cope with stress, and sometimes we are eating to comfort our emotions, and sometimes we are eating because we've got something stuck in our head that we've been restricting, like, oh,
even now,
I'm like, oh, I can't possibly have that. And like, I will deliberately, whenever I have that food thought, I go out, I buy the thing, I buy it in excess.
Yeah, same.
I like eat it until I'm like, oh, I can't even look at that again. But I know that's what we do with intuitive eating, but I make that a practice regularly because I just don't want to become fixated on food. I say that, but it's still a journey and I still struggle and I go through periods when I'm not feeling great about it. I'm also very conscious of my hormones and how they impact things. I'm conscious of my just my moods in general. Sometimes I am lacking in energy and I need food because it's going to give me the brain food. Sometimes I just want to hibernate with a bar of chocolate. Sometimes, and I just, I think, you know, one of the things about diabetes is you're told you absolutely cannot do that for the rest of your life. It's not like for next year, yeah. It's for the rest of your life. You'll never be able to do that again. And that can be a very bitter pill to swallow. And I don't think it's accurate. I think if it, look, if someone said to me, you eat, like my daughter, for example, she went through a period of time when she was diagnosed with a very serious allergy and she couldn't have dairy. She's never going to have dairy. Like that's the end of it.
Yeah.
But if it's just like, oh, maybe if you cut down dairy, it might help, but we don't know. Good luck with that. Never have dairy again for the rest of your life. Like, that's not the same thing.
Totally. Also, the first one, when there are consequences that are so unavoidable, it doesn't often feel like restriction the same way. Like, people with gluten allergies are rarely like, maybe I'll be naughty and have a little gluten. They're like, I will stay out of the ER and not shit myself for the next 3 days by not eating gluten. Like, this is not a hard, restrictive feeling choice. Sometimes, sure. And I know having a relationship with food that has like a history of an eating disorder, some of these things can feel restrictive just because it's hard to process that stuff. I work with clients sometimes through the like intuitive eating plus some kind of health restriction and how to navigate that. It's tricky. But yeah, I think it all often does come back to the idea that like there's a moral superiority to never, ever making a choice that's bad for you in the short term. As if we weren't totally freaking designed to make bad choices in the short term sometime.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, when I was coming off, I was having all this weird stuff coming off meds. I was so hungry all the time and I had all these cravings. I had cravings very specifically for sour gummy candies, which I know hurt my stomach if I eat more than a small quantity. But like every night, 4 weeks, I was eating a pretty large quantity because I wanted them so badly. And I was like, I refuse to give myself a weird thing about this in the future. So like 2.5 weeks of sort of belly aches going to bed, so worth never thinking about it again. Because the alternative would be I develop a weird thing about this or I'm getting in my head about food in a way that I'm like, that's a long term. I can avoid that with a couple of belly aches. It's so worth it.
100%. I couldn't agree more. I think from a health perspective, I think that is so true. Like, you know, talking as a health professional, I agree with everything you just said.
Okay. So going back a little bit, because I want to have you talk about standing up for yourself at the doctor. I think it's hilarious that you allow a person, given what you do, to like give you dietary advice that you're just like, no, and she knows you're not going to take. But like, I know you have this material coming out. I know you do a lot of work in this space to make sure people understand that self-advocacy inside of a medical space is a skill. It can be built and cultivated. There are support and resources out there for you to be able to do it. Most people probably assume that you just get told what you get told. You get bounced around the way you get bounced around. Personally, I encourage all my clients to not get weighed at the doctor's office, even if they don't have their own personal trigger, because I believe it makes the more of us who can do it safely, who can step into that uncomfortable conversation with the NP or whatever it is, then the more often an NP has heard of this before, right? Like, it's like we're spreading it even if we're not the beneficiaries. So I always refuse to get weighed. I did have someone, it was like a scale plus height thing. And she was like, no problem, just step on and I'll like, you know, do the height thing. And I did. And I like stood there all grouchy. Like, I was like, I shouldn't have even stepped on. I could tell her how tall I am. This is not.
I was going to say, unless you're a kid, that's not changing.
And it doesn't matter in the slightest. And I felt duped anyway, but like, it's a skill. So tell me about how you, like the resources you offer and how you support people in that space.
I think I think the word skill is exactly right. First of all, I think that I still am angry about the fact that I've had to create these resources. No one should have to learn how to advocate for themselves in the doctor's office, because doctors should be doing that for you. Kind of what we get paid for. But I live in the real world and I understand this is something that people really need. And it's the first thing people ask me when I got into this space. It's how do you advocate for yourself, doctor? I developed like an entire framework for this. And it begins well before you actually step into the doctor's office. I talk about stress and the stress response. I talk about communication. I talk about why we behave the way that we behave when we go and see a doctor and why that is often very different to how we behave in other situations and circumstances. I think it really empowers people to know why it's happening. Like, why can't I talk back to my doctor? Why can't I say no to being weighed? It's one thing to know that you should. It's another thing to be able to do it. And so we talk about this. We talk about the framework sort of talks about what to expect from your doctors and your health professionals, like what you should expect from each of them. Again, most people don't know this. I never thought about the fact that people didn't know this because I've always been a doctor. But of course, most people don't know this. And then we actually talk about going into the consultation, how to set an agenda and how to basically take control of the narrative, because that's what you need to be able to do. You need to be able to walk in there. And as the NP or whoever is bringing you in and wants to get you weighed, you need to be able to, before you step foot in the room, go, just, I'm going to stop you before you ask, I'm not getting weighed today. You know, it's very different to being asked to step on the scale and then go, well, actually, I'd rather not. You want to be really assertive, and assertiveness is not something that comes naturally to us when it comes to health professionals, because they are, you know, they are afforded a certain status that we have not got. And then we talk about taking control of the narrative. We talk about how to handle different aspects of the consultation. So look, what happens when you're told there's nothing wrong with you, when clearly, you know, there is, all sorts of things like that. And then we talk about the aftermath, like what happens afterwards, what happens when you don't get the care you need, what happens if you're being denied care based on your BMI, you're being told you can't have this because of your BMI, things like that. So it's, you know, it's actually a really long process. And that's why I developed, like, you know, like an 8-part framework. I've got a course called Take Your Power Back, which is literally about empowering you in the doctor's office. And it couldn't just be separate. I couldn't just do like 5 top tips. Like, I can give you my 5 top tips, but it doesn't work. But I have some free resources on my website if you're interested. And if you're interested in Take Your Power Back, again, you can access that through my website. I'm coming up now, though, with a new course, which is called Unshrinkable, which I'm super proud of. Just because I was saying to you earlier, I love the name, Unshrinkable. It's based on the fact that we are unshrinkable, as I've explained earlier on. And so this is a course that's all about how to take up space in the doctor's office, how to like handle or challenge weight loss advice, bariatric surgery advice, stuff like that. You know, how to, and to understand why we are unshrinkable. So a lot of the stuff was talking about today is part of the course material, where I really break it down and explain exactly what's going on so that people can feel confident in their advocacy. Because like I said, I go in there, and this nurse, she knows me, I know her. She knows she's not getting me to lose weight. And I know that there's no fighting with her to try to convince her that she shouldn't advise me to lose weight, because she's sure that she should advise me, and I'm sure that I'm not going to do it. But we have this little back and forth where she's like, hey, you should lose weight, so that she can tick a box on the computer saying that she's And I can go, you know, stick my finger up and go, it's never going to happen. And then we move on. To be able to have that kind of conversation with your healthcare professional, perhaps that's the best you're ever going to get. But believe me, it's a lot better than it has been in the past. So, yeah, Unshrinkable is a course that I'm doing. I'm so excited to be able to teach it. And as I said, there are resources on my website. If you sign up to my emails, you get me you basically get this in email form every day. Me being like, have you seen this study? This is I actually do a lot of like Dear Abby type style questions where people are like, you know, my doctor said this, what should I do? And I answer
it. That's clever.
Yeah.
That's awesome. By the way, the thing you just said about being assertive, it really makes me think of when I was younger and I had super bad social anxiety, and like my absolute dread in the morning was like being in an elevator and someone turns to me and is like, what's up or whatever. It's like the moment of like wanting to sink into the floor and disappear, the panic that I felt about that moment. I don't even know why. I couldn't have even told you at the time. But what I discovered was, the key for me of not being anxious anymore was that I was the one that said good morning first. It's like there's something so empowering about taking the space, stepping, literally using your voice, being the first one to be like, good morning. And then they get to say it back and the moment is done. Whereas for whatever reason, I would spend the entire elevator ride being like, are they going to say it? What am I going to say if they do? You know, it's like it really just, it's so much of taking up the space and reclaiming your power. It makes so much sense that that would be true in a doctor's office too.
It's funny, one of, like, I can't remember, module 5, something like that, we do the first minute of the consultation, and I give like almost a script where I explain that you must get the first word in, and if you just happen that your doctor stops you before you get a chance, I like teach you how to interrupt
and
get the first word in, because I genuinely believe, like, it's like setting intentions, setting the agenda. When you walk in there and you sit down and you know what you're about to do, and before they even open your mouth, you can say, right, so, and then you're leading the conversation. Honestly, it changes everything.
Yeah.
And I've tried this and I love it. And I actually use it not just in the medical consultation now, I use it everywhere. You're right. We, especially if you have, if you exist in a marginalized body, or you have social anxiety or whatever, like you've been conditioned to believe that, or even just if you're a woman, or you were, you know, you were socially conditioned as a woman, you've been conditioned to believe that you only speak when you're spoken to. And the way things change the moment you basically take on the role of, now I'm the boss here. And and you know, you are, you get that your doctors are being paid to work for you.
Right.
Not the other way around. They get paid a lot of money to do, to literally let you, to give you what you need. So once you begin to switch that, and you, as you say, you're the one that goes in and says good morning and and let's begin. And let me tell you what's going to happen today, which is what we do in the first minute. We set out our ideas, our concerns, and our expectations, so that by the time the doctor opens their mouth, they've got no choice but to follow. What are they going to say? No, I want you to do things my way. No, they won't. They'll just follow along.
Right. Ooh, I love it. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing all of this and for being here, everybody. I am going to link to some of these resources and things that we've been talking about. I would love that article if you have it. I'll include that. Go follow Asher. Go sign up for his email list and read all the resources and take your power back at the doctor's office, et cetera, et cetera. Also, continue, I don't know, unlearning the fact that everything you learned is wrong. It's kind of a big task there, but I feel like some of what we talked about, especially in that space of diabetes, like, it's so, so important that we continue learning, 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 because we are pushing back against stuff that feels so common sense at this point that literally there's no room to learn anymore. It's become indoctrinated into our brains. We don't even have space to take in new information because we're like, well, that just can't be true. Mm-hmm. Everything literally anyone has ever told me goes against that. But who told you? Probably, as you mentioned, you know, diet culture has their fingers in all the pots. So, thank you so much for being here. Where can people find you? Social media, website, whatever.
Just go to fatdoctor.co.uk. Remember, I'm co.uk, not com. I live in the UK, very proud, and .org was too expensive. So it's fatdoctor.co.uk. You can find everything there, including the free resources, sign up to my emails, get the courses, whatever, and my socials, if you care to join me there too.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being here. And to my listeners, thank you for being here, and I will catch you next week. Hey everyone, I'm Jesse Nealand, and I want to take a moment to thank you for listening to this episode of the This Is Not About Your Body podcast. I put out new episodes every Tuesday, so be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss it. And if you really enjoyed it, please go ahead and leave me a review. Also, if you're looking for more information about body neutrality or you want to work with me, you can find me at my website, jessenealand.com. Or you can just purchase my book, Body Neutral, A Revolutionary Guide to Overcoming Body Image Issues, wherever you buy books, ebooks, or audiobooks. We can also connect on Instagram or TikTok. My handle is Jesse Nealand. And because I make this podcast available for free and without any sponsors or ads, you can also feel free to show your support using the Patreon link in the show notes. And know that your support, if you decide to participate, is always very much appreciated. Lastly, thank you to my brother, Jason Nealand, for creating the music that plays at the beginning of the show. And thank you for listening, learning, and moving toward personal and collective body liberation.